was wondering if the Rook could tell us. I heard from somebody that he saw an article, and the author of the article posited that two Rishonim formed their opinions on Goyim based on their experiences that they experienced with Goyim. One positive because he was persecuted. One negative because he was persecuted, and one positive because they invented Christ. And he wanted to say that the Rishonim and Gedolim generally are not influenced by those sort of external forces and things that happen in their lives to come to halakhic conclusions. Is that a fair thing to say? Not specifically on this issue, but generally.
I'm sorry, the author was saying they are influenced or they're not influenced?
Sorry?
The author was saying they are influenced or they are not
influenced.
They are, because he was probably, yes. That's a very, very hard question. I mean, initially, every Gadol B'Torah looks at the Makoros, looks at the halachic texts, and tries to be very objective, and does try to factor out the individual mitzias in their lives. But the truth of the matter is that that process, by definition, cannot be fail-safe. And the truth of the matter is, part of the divine hashkacha is that a gadol will experience certain things that will cause him to see things in a certain way. Now, you could call that subjective, but you could also say the hashkacha pratis is that the gadol should come to that conclusion. For example, you know, we say that generally Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, right? Beis Shammai is usually machmir, and Beis Hillel is mekel. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean Beis Hillel gets up every morning, or Hillel gets up every morning and says, I'm going to find a way to be easy? Certainly not. What went through Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai's minds, both as Hillel and Shammai and as their yeshivos, was to look at things as objectively as possible. But every neshama has a different kesher to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So spiritually, the kesher of Beis Hillel was to meet us HaRachamim, and the kesher of Beis Shammai was to meet us HaDin, and therefore when they come to what is an objective reality, they will see things different ways, and that is part of the kochos that Hashem put in their neshama. Now, what I'm saying is not quite the same thing, but one might draw an analogy that the same way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu imprinted special kochos in every neshama, in which they look at things differently, not out of a conscious desire to distort the truth, chas v'shalom, but Hashem made them that they see the truth differently. I think that is also true to some degree to the subjective experiences of a person's life. Let me give you an interesting example of this. You know, everyone knows the famous Gemara in Megillah that when the Egyptians were drowning, Rav Yochanan says that the Malachi Asharis wanted to say Shira to Hashem, but Hashem said back to them, Maise Yadai Tavu Bayam, my creations are drowning in the sea. V'atem Omrim Shira, you want to sing a song of joy when my creations are drowning in the sea. Now the Bavli takes Rav Yochanan's words and it clearly understands that the Maise Yadai are the Mitzrayim, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is expressing commiseration and rachmanas and compassion for the Egyptians. That's how we commonly quote that Gemara, and that's what the Gemara clearly means there. But if you look at the Talmud Yerushalmi takes the same words, Maisa Yadai Tavu Bayam Vatem Aymrim Shira, as Hashem is saying, don't sing yet, the Jewish people are still in the water, and they don't deserve redemption. Meaning, Maisa Yadai, the Jews are still in Sakana, wait until they're out of the water. Now, that actually means that the same words, according to the Bavli, is Rachmanis for the Goyim, and according to the Yerushalmi, we're not thinking about the Goyim, we're concerned about Am Yisrael itself. So some want to suggest that indeed both are going to be true. The Yerushalmi lived at a time, or the Amoram of the Yerushalmi lived at a time of great Roman persecution. They saw the Goyim as evil, they saw the Goyim as bad. So just like one wouldn't say, we should be so sad that Hitler got killed, or whatever it is, one wouldn't think that way. So the Yerushalmi doesn't learn that way. The Bavli, people lived at a time in Bavel where the Goyim were relatively benign. So the answer is that sometimes there may be opposite ways of approaching a halacha, and that may be affected by the subjectivity of experience, but it's not truly subjective. Meaning to say, if you intend to decide the halacha based on your subjectivity, that is sheker, that is puzzle, that is no good. You have to be mishtadal to decide the halacha very, very objectively. But your way of thinking will be influenced by things that happened, and that's part of the hashgacha practice of the halachic process itself. Yeah.
Just to, if I could just continue on that, just to ask it in the area of hashgacha, it seems like the Baal HaTanya and the Rambam seems like also they're very different. Like, it seems like the Baal HaTanya has like almost like a genetic problem with goyim, like they're genetically. Like,
that's very true. That's very true.
The Rambam seems to think that you know they're
yeah.
So like and also I might say that. That Baal HaTanya was extremely persecuted, and we have, like, you know, in a month he like gets out of jail, you know. Yep. Like, he was like, you know, while Rambam was in.
I think you're making a very good point. Of course, the Rambam himself dealt with Islamic persecutions. That you know, the Rambam left Eretz Yisrael. In his early 20s because of his fanatical Islamic persecution. So the Rambam did suffer from them as well. But it is a very good point. I mean, certainly the distinction you're drawing between the Baal HaTanya and the Rambam is absolutely valid. The Rambam is really a meritocracy. The Rambam does not give you privileges by virtue of birth. You know, if you keep the mitzvahs, you're good. If you don't, you're no good. And a guy who keeps the mitzvahs, Sheva mitzvahs, is good. In other words, there's no concept you're automatically great because you're Jewish, as opposed to the Baal HaTanya, who basically did build up this idea. Once again, on many of these matters, we say, Eilu v'eilu divrei Elokim chayim. How do you reconcile opposite views there is going to be difficult. But yeah, let me give you another example. You know, one of the mitzvahs of the Torah is to appoint a king. Most Rishonim, based on the Gemara and Sanhedrin, say the appointing of a king is a mitzvah. Saim Tasim Olecha Melech is one of the Tayag mitzvahs in the Torah. And then they have a whole big kasha. So why is Shmuel so angry at the Jewish people when they ask for a melech? And they have many, many answers. But the kasha starts off based on the predicate that Saim Tasim Olecha Melech is a mitzvah. Well, that's indeed the halacha, but the Abarbanel, the great Mefarish, who was very, very high in the Spanish government, writes a big arichos and says it's a dover pashat, that monarchs are not good, kings are not good, kings are corrupt, kings are dishonest, and at most, that same tosim halacha, meaning if you're going to have a king, it has to be a Jewish king, etc., but certainly you're better off without a king. And then, this is very unusual, in his Perush on Shmuel, and in his Perush and Devarim as well, he goes through a long discussion about Ferdinand and Isabella, which were the king and the queen of Spain. Remember, they were the ones who expelled the Jews from Spain. They were the ones who financed Columbus's expedition to America. And he said, and the Abarbanel, he was given, because he was the money man, he was given Rishus to stay in Spain and remain Jewish. The only Jew that was given that permission not to convert, he refused to take them up, and he went into exile with everybody else, and he went to the Italian city-states, Florence and Venice and Milan, and he said, ah, that's a government. Term limits, you know, you're limited, you're elected, you dare not abuse your power because 3 years from then you're going to be subject to the people you were abusing. And it's a whole essay on democracy and, you know, Republican form of government. Now, the Abarbanel uses, what is the Abarbanel doing? He's explicitly using the personal experiences he had with bad kings to say it's not shayach for the Torah to say that having a melech is a mitzvah. So I think it's a very clear example of that. Now, one little paradox of the Abarbanel. On one hand, the Abarbanel is the only Rishon who explicitly says having a king is not a mitzvah. And yet the Abarbanel is also the Rishon who wrote the most and in the most detail about Mashiach. The Abarbanel is a great, great writer of whole Svarim, interpreting the Nevuas of Daniel, etc. And he goes into Yemos Mashiach and Gog and Magog, and he says over and over again, Mashiach is indeed a flesh and blood king that is a descendant of David HaMelech. So it's interesting that the anti-monarchist, when it's Bidei Basar V'dam, certainly is a monarchist when it comes to the Ikrei Emuna of Mashiach, etc., who will not have all of those abuses. But, I mean, you can't doubt that the Abarbanel, okay, the Abarbanel is not a Paisek here, but you cannot doubt that the Abarbanel's understanding of the Torah was influenced by his understanding of life. But in a sense, You can't avoid that, because, I mean, what do Chazal do? Chazal make a, let's say when Chazal make a gezeira, certainly, gezeira, takana, don't do this because you'll come to this. Or they make rules that a person only keeps his shtar, right, to take what you're learning, a person only keeps his shtar for 3 years after a transaction. That is not a halacha l'moshe misinai. Chazal look at the world, and they have to make judgments based on human behaviors. So Chazal are looking at people all the time. That has an input. How you see the world does have. But again, the only thing we have to condemn as apikorsis is the kind of preconceived notion, where out of your head you say, we have to make men and women equal, therefore it has to be that a woman could be a rabbi or something like that. That would be an illegitimate process. But when you try to be objective, you look at the world and you have to take in what you see and you build maskanas on that. I understand this is a very, very slippery, delicate slope, so to speak. But there's no question that there is a human input in terms of understanding halacha and applying halacha. Yeah.
Why do we no longer prostrate during prayer?
You're talking about getting on our knees?
Yeah. I was reading in the Midrash, It said like all these things were due to the merit of prostration, or the prostration merited us many things.
Well, certainly. There is, number one, a problem that, number one, these were associated and later became more associated with idolatry and pagan worship, Christianity as well. So think of things that were considered to be appropriated by the Goyim in their worship, we generally avoid. Also, there are many, many halachas about prostration. There are halachas, for example, if you do it on a stone. On Yom Kippur, we don't do, our minhag is not to do a full prostration. Right? We go on our knees. But the Vilna Gaon actually said, and he was noeg, that on Yom Kippur, he would do a full body, meaning he would lie straight, which is the real prostration. You're totally on your stomach. But there are many, many halachas. You know, you're not supposed to do it on a stone floor. Some people were machmir outside of the Beis HaMikdash, not even on a floor that has a hefsik, like a rug or a carpet or the like. So I would say that there are three reasons why we avoid prostration today, usually. Number one, it's associated with idolatry and chukos hagoyim. Number two, there are halachic uncertainties outside of the Beis HaMikdash, whether you're allowed to prostrate. You can't do it on a stone floor, and some are machmer even with a rug. And number three, there is actually a statement in the Gemara itself that, of course, it's not so clear what the statement means, but the statement says, Ein Adam Rishoi Lipol Al Panav. A person is not allowed to fall on his face in a prostration unless he knows he will be answered like Yehoshua bin Nun. Now, what does it mean, he knows he's going to be answered? So the basic idea, the Marsha says, is the idea that prostration is what a righteous person does to be Ma'or Hashem's Rachamim. But you have to be, paradoxically, in order to lower yourself, you have to be on a very, very high level. Because then your statement of humility is sincere, right? Because when you prostrate yourself, you are humbling yourself. But when you're not so righteous, and you're arrogant, and you're conceited, and you're a balgaiva, your prostration is a fake profession of a humility that is not in your heart. And when you fake humility and it's not in your heart, that becomes the biggest gaiva, that becomes the biggest arrogance. And therefore Hashem hates it. So part of it is that we're not on the madrega to be humble enough to humble ourselves. So, I mean, those are kind of the reasons. But I'll tell you one thing I actually read from Rabbi Avigdor Miller, who's, you know, contemporary person. He was nifter a few years ago. Very, very chashuv person. That he suggested, I don't know how many people do this, he suggested as a private exercise, not in front of people, that every day a person prostrate himself, you know, with a towel and everything else, and say, Hashem, I accept you as my king. He actually said that was an idea to help a person develop a relationship with Hashem. So you kind of anticipate that idea. But those are the reasons why we don't do it in the Beis Knesset itself.
And Just a follow-up. Yep. I guess this would apply to all minhagim. I'm like saying, meaning the cessation of prostration is a minhag now.
Yep.
It's a minhag not to prostrate.
That's correct.
So how would one go about, or is it possible for one, for that to be repealed? Can you repeal minhagim?
That's a good question. Paradoxically, if you had kehilos that's tried to start a new minhag, they initially would be sinning because they're violating a minhag, but then it might become a minhag that later generations might be able to do. It's kind of a circular reasoning. But generally speaking, if minhagim are very universal in Am Yisrael, they should not be changed. It's one thing if something is Ashkenaz or Sfard, so you could go over to the other side a little bit. You could mix and match a little bit, although that has to, you have to ask a shayla about when can you mix and match. But if something is a real universal minhag, you have to assume. You know, the Rama writes that every minhag has significance, even if we don't understand it. Somebody wanted to stop making noise for Haman's name, you know, in Purim. When we say Haman, everybody, you know, we make noise. It's a way of erasing a Amalek. And, you know, it creates problems sometimes. If the kids are going on too long, some people might miss some words of the Balkore. So there was a Rav who wanted to stop that minhag. You know, no noise. You know, we don't need to make noise. And the Ramar writes, very stark, you are not allowed to be mezalzel, to cheapen any minhag of Am Yisrael, because even if we don't understand the reason that much, there must be a spiritual significance. Now, the Rama, of course, was talking about a minhag to do something. Here we're talking about a minhag not to do something.
The minhag before that was to do something. I'm assuming the prostration was a minhag?
Yes, but it's not required as a halacha per se. In the Beis HaMikdash, the Kohanim did bow down every day. Prostration was done in the Beis HaMikdash every single day. But you know, I'll give you an example. It's only an example. You know, there's a Mizbeach, which is of many stones, an altar, and there's a Matseva, that's a single stone. And the Torah actually says, when you build a Mizbeach, it must be made of many stones. You cannot use the Matseva. And Rashi brings the Chazal that says, even though the Matseva was once beloved to me in the days of the Avos, because that's Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov brought Korbanos on Matseva, but it has now become hated to me, because that is what the idolaters do. So you see this idea that something that was beloved, Hashem says, is no longer acceptable. Now I don't have the same pasuk for prostration. I can't say we have the same pasuk, but spiritually there could be a similar idea. Yeah.
Going off on the minhagim thing a little bit, how is it that modern Israelis have kind of created a new minhag, a new nusach of prayer that everyone is doing sfard in a random shul, and the nusach of pronunciation is not either sfardi or Ashkenazi, but the way that they would pronounce normal language. So how did that like come about, and is that valid?
So you're referring to pronunciation, not text. I mean, an Israeli show will either do Ashkenaz or Sephardic or Eidut HaMizrach. I mean, but you're referring to the pronunciation of Hebrew.
And also that the majority of shuls here do Nusach Sephardic, where assuming, let's say, prior to people coming to Israel, seven years ago, then like people weren't doing Nusach Sephardic. So how did everyone move to that, and how... and the pronunciation as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, those are both good questions. As you pointed out quite correctly, although people commonly call the Israeli pronunciation of Hebrew Sephardic Hebrew, it actually is not a Sephardic Hebrew. It's a new mishmash, taking some stuff from Ashkenaz, some stuff from Sephard, etc. And it's modern Hebrew. Modern Hebrew. In fact, many people say modern Hebrew is a new language, although it's very related to Hebrew, or Lashon HaKodesh, but it's not Lashon HaKodesh. Ad Kedei Kach, just to give you a little example, although it's not your question per se, you know, the word, the modern Hebrew is essentially invented by one person, although many people added to it later, and this is the famous or infamous, depending, Eliezer ben Yehuda, whose name was Eliezer Perlman, a Russian fellow who was very anti-religious, but he did have an obsession. He wanted to bring Hebrew back as a spoken language in everyday conversation. which really had not been the case. I mean, in the people of the old Yishuv spoke Yiddish, just as today. And he was very fanatic, and he basically created. He created Hebrew as a spoken language, and he had to invent a lot of words. And he would often use Gemaras and Midrashim as a basis for new words. But of course, since he didn't know Gemara and Midrash, he needed Rabbanim that would help him. Most Rabbanim did not talk to him at all, but Rav Kook used to talk to him. So he used to go to Rav Kook, and he would ask Rav Kook the meaning of this word. So let's take the word for electricity, right? Eliezer Ben Yehuda is living in whatever is 1905. You know, what word should I have for electricity? So he figured, chashmal is a good word. Now, what is Chashmal? Chashmal is from Yechezkel. It's describing the Merkava of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the celestial throne, and it talks about the celestial throne being surrounded by a radiant light of brilliance called Chashmal. Okay, so I'll take a term that is referring to the Shekhinah, the Kisei HaKavod, something even higher than the Shekhinah, and I'm going to use it for an electric light bulb. Now, there are people, Ada Yom Hazeh, that although I have to admit that even Shlomo Zalman used Chashmal, but there are people, Ada Yom Hazeh, that refuse to use the word Chashmal for electricity. They say it is sacrilegious, they say it is a bizoyan to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and they will write electric, which anyway in Hebrew half the words are English. They will use this anglicized form. I believe Rav Moshe usually wrote electric or whatever it is. He did not write Chashmal. Okay, so number one, the pronunciation is not according to any particular minhag. Well, the truth of the matter is, this was and it is somewhat of a very big shaila. There are those that are very, very machmer, that a person is mechuyev in his tefillah to follow the minhag of his forefathers, whether it's Edut HaMizrach or Ashkenaz or Sfard, and you should not be Mishaneh. However, the prevailing consensus in pronunciation of Hebrew is that you can follow a minhag of a kahal, and a kahal has reshus, as it were, to almost invent a new havara as long as it's linked to something, on the grounds that nobody knows the original pronunciation of Lashon HaKodesh. Some people say Temani is the closest to Lashon HaKodesh, but some people disagree. Some people say Temani is connected to Arabic, meaning a lot of the the Temani pronunciations, like the wa for the vav, is really Arabic and not Hebrew. So as a result, it is said that since we don't know the original pronunciation, so we are permitted to do this. However, many people are machmir, including in this yeshiva, that for Parshas Zachor, that is a doraisa, a person hears the Parshas Zachor in his havara. And similarly, for the recitation of Kriya Shema, one should say Yor Havara, right? So there are different opinions on this, and it is halachically very, very questionable. In terms of Nusach Sfarad, in terms of Nusach, that already is a little bit different, because it is not so pashut that you are mechuyev to stay with the Nusach of your forefathers if you are part of a kihilah that has decided to go the other way. Now, Rav Moshe does paskin. If I'm an Ashkenazi davening in a Sephardi congregation, I should daven my Ashkenaz davening, except for the things that are said with the minyan, where I say it like the minyan. That is Rav Moshe's psak. So according to Rav Moshe, there really wouldn't be a justification. On the other hand, other poskim say that when you're in any minyan, you do what the minyan is doing legamri, and it's not a shaila of not being yotzei. And as a result, there is a makom to makel on that. But that wouldn't be true necessarily for pronunciations, where for Kriya Shema and Parshas Zachor, one should be machmer. Now, I have to say, you know, when I learned Hebrew, and I probably knew Hebrew better in second grade than I know now, so I learned it from an old European teacher, Zichrono Livracha, wonderful, wonderful Hebrew teacher, and he still spoke Ashkenazis Hebrew. Now, this is an extinct language. Ashkenazis, this is a grammatical Hebrew, fully grammatical, with the right accents and everything, in which you say, Ani, you know, Shmachakeh l'shabos. Now, that is an actual language. That was a language of Hebrew. It is not spoken anymore. Even in Mei Hashem, they'll speak Yiddish. They'll say Shabbos. Shabbos is not Hebrew. Shabbos is Yiddish. But Ashkenazis, it is Shabbos, and in the modern Hebrew, as Sephardic, it's Shabbat. So Ashkenazis was equally valid to Sephardic. Ashkenazis, in fact, some say, was the language that was spoken in Eretz Yisrael, and what is called Sephardic was the Hebrew spoken in Bava. So actually Ashkenazis, there is some historical support that it was more of a native Israeli language. So why did Eliezer ben Yehuda not like that, right? Certainly when he learned how to read Hebrew in Russia, they taught it Ashkenazic reading. The answer was, once again, he associated Ashkenazic Jews with frumkeit, religiosity, and mitzvos, and he wanted to create a Hebrew that was not connected to any of that European heritage. So he simply liked the Oriental, it was more exotic, etc. And that's why it was a total artificial decision. There was no logic at all in his decision, and he simply went with it because he wanted to cut off any ties to the Eastern European diaspora. One little story about Eliezer ben Yehuda, as I say, many of the rabbanim didn't want to talk to him because he was not only not religious, but he was actually anti-religious in many, many ways. But the story goes that one Friday he came to Rav Kook to ask about some midrashim, and Rav Kook gave him the answers. Then Rav Kook said, Eliezer, isn't it time to do tshuva already? And Eliezer ben Yehuda said, perhaps the Rav is right. That Friday night he died in his sleep. And the Levaya was Saturday night, Motzei Shabbos. Very, very few Rabbanim came, but Rav Kook came. And Rav Kook was maspidim. He said that he feels Eliezer ben Yehuda died a Baal Tshuva because the day before, the day of his death, he said, the Rav is right, I should do Tshuva. And Rav Kook said, that's enough for me to put him on a chazaka that he did Tshuva right before his death, and that is enough to give forgiveness. So this is Rav Kook judging people. L'kav schos, yeah.
How come sometimes Chazal, when they make tikkunas, they'll make a tikkuna in case it's not Shkiyah, but sometimes a tikkuna might no longer apply because it's not a Shkiyah case? It seems to be sometimes there's an inconsistency.
In other words, you're saying when they initially make a tikkuna, they're not going to make a tikkuna for an unusual case. Is that what you're starting off with, or you're saying they did?
Or they would, sometimes they might make it for an unusual case to prevent something.
Right.
Then it might not. A different tikkuna might not apply because it's no longer.
Oh, you're saying sometimes we invoke the rule. It's milsud lo shechicha, so we don't make the tikkuna, and sometimes we seem to make tikkunas for things that are lo shechicha. You know, I have to tell you, I don't know the answer. It's a very good question. It is very, very difficult to understand tikkunas and gezeiros. That is why the Rishonim already say, ein medamin gezeiros lahadadi, meaning what they did in one case, you cannot use as a logic in another case. Marisayin is another example. Sometimes we're so concerned for, even if something is mutter, we forbid it because of appearances. There are other times in which we're not machmer because of appearances. The only thing I can tell you is that Rev Dessler writes, and I think I mentioned this last week in connection with another thing, Rev Dessler writes that Chazal had many, many additional reasons besides the reasons that they revealed. So even if the reason that they revealed would seem not to apply to this case, or it shouldn't apply to that case, there may be other reasons, like a tip of the iceberg. Just to remind you what he said this by. He said this by the very difficult shaila that Chazal say you're allowed to kill a louse on Shabbos because lice do not reproduce sexually, and the issur of killing on Shabbos is only things that reproduce from Zachor on the Keva. And the big problem, the Mavuche, that early Achronim had was that when it was discovered that everything is sexually reproduced, so does that mean Chazal made a mistake? Does that mean you're allowed? In other words, now it should be, this is not even a mistake to be machmer. This is a mistake that allows something that should scientifically be Chilul Shabbos min HaTorah. This is very different. You can't just say be machmer. So Rav Dessler writes that Chazal had kama v'kama tamim, and if the reason they revealed was appropriate for the science of the time, even when that science is undermined, there'll be other tamim as well. So, you know, your question is a very, very excellent question. This is really nichlal in ein medamin gezeiros lahadadi. But also I do want to add that sometimes what we think is a milsud lo shechicha may not have been a milsud. Now, people often say, you're not allowed to go swimming on Shabbos because maybe you'll make a raft. That's the reason it says. So, you know, the average person today says, well, make a raft. I don't remember ever making a raft. You know, I don't make a raft. And that sounds to me like a milsa de lo shechicha. But, you know, who knows? At that time, it may have been shechiach enough. And then, if it later becomes lo shechicha, that's not mevatel takana. Once the takana gezera was made, it can only be repealed by a beis din that is greater in chachma and minyan. Right? So sometimes we're using our own judgment as to what is lo shechiach, and that may not be the case. By the way, I just tell you an interesting little story. You know, the Gemara in Chulin, there's a din. There's a din in the Shulchan Aruch based on the Gemara called Basar Shenisalem Minayin. That if there was meat and the meat was unsupervised, you walked out of the house and Goyim had access to the meat, you have, unless it's sealed in some way, you actually have to be afraid that the guy took your meat and put in some non-kosher meat in its place. Unless it's wrapped, unless it's sealed, and the like. So the story goes, one of my rabbis, Rav Chesky Zichrono Livracha, this is the actual story. He was once on a plane, and they brought him a kosher sandwich. You know, so I assume it was Mahadran kosher sandwich. And he was sitting next to a guy. And Rav Chesky got up to do Netila Shadayim. And when he got back, he realized all of a sudden, with kind of a sickening feeling, you know, gee, I left my seat. And the guy had his sandwich and my sandwich. That's called basar shenisalem minayin. I'm not allowed to eat the sandwich. So he didn't eat. I think maybe he nibbled the bread, al samotzi or something, but he would not eat the meat. So his seatmate asks him, he says, why aren't you eating the meat? It looks like a good sandwich. He says, well, there's a law that, he didn't want to insult the guy, but there's a law that if I wasn't watching the meat, I can't eat it because maybe it's not kosher, maybe it got switched. So the person says, come on, what a crazy thing is that? Who's going to switch? I mean, I have a sandwich, you have a sandwich. Who's going to switch the meat? Come on. Why do you keep these crazy laws? So he says, well, this is our law and we have to keep this law. So the guy told him, you know, I want to tell you something. I wanted to know what kosher pastrami tastes like. I never tasted. I wanted to see if it was the same. So I took a piece of mine and I switched it with yours. And I figured nobody would know the difference. He says, and now you tell me that that's exactly the halacha. Right? Now, so it's an amazing thing. So we think that these rules don't make sense and, you know, they're not important and they're stupid. They talk of work in the real, they, you know, Chazal knew what they were talking about. Yeah,
if Israel's a law, then why is it that we have Ashkenazi and Sephardi, and that there's differences, say, in the davening, that are both equally valid? Why aren't they supposed to be coherent throughout?
Yeah, an excellent question. We have so many subdivisions, Ashkenazim, Sephardim, within Ashkenazim, Hasidim and non-Hasidim, within Hasidim, many, many different types of Hasidim, within non-Hasidim, many, many different types, whether it's Brisk or Chazonish or Yeshiva or Dati Liumi, says, aren't we supposed to be one nation? Isn't that what Achdus is about? So let me just go back that indeed, the essence of Klal Yisrael is actually a unity that is reflected in diversity. Let's go back to the idea of tribes. In the Torah itself, there's a very big deal about 12 Shvatim. And each Shevet had a flag in the desert, it had a Nasi, it had its own territory. According to some, the 13 gates of the Beis HaMikdash, one for each tribe, and the 13th gate is for those who didn't know their tribe, etc. And Shvatim is a big deal. Now today we don't make a big deal because we don't even know our Shevet unless you're a Kohen or a Levi. But Shvatim were a very, very big deal. There was even a law in the Torah, albeit a temporary law, that a woman from one tribe who inherited property was not even allowed to marry a man from another tribe, lest the inheritance go from tribe to tribe. Now you might think, what is this business about tribes? Why is it important? I need to self-identify as a Reuven or a Shimon or a Yisachar. I'm a Jew. I'm a Yid. I'm B'nai Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Why is there a concept of tribalism? Why would that even be important? And the aside of this is a very, very important idea, that each Shevet had a different spiritual path towards Hashem. Each served Hashem within the framework of the Torah, of course, but each served Hashem in a unique and a different way. Yisachar was the Shevet that learned Torah, Zebulun also learned Torah, but Zebulun, its main aliyah was in supporting Yisachar. And the concept basically is that Hashem doesn't want everybody to be the same. Hashem understands, and He made us this way. Every neshama has a different way of connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. and therefore, by analogy to the tribes, Ashkenazim, Sfardim, Taimanim, Hasidim, Misnagdim, it's not a question of one is false. Now, there are such things as false. I mean, the Reform movement, I can say, is false, although I don't fault individual reformers. There are things that are false. Advocating for gay marriage is false. But within the framework of those who keep the Torah, it is not one is right and one is wrong. Rather, different individuals need different ways to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, the big challenge is to keep unity within that diversity and don't let the diversity become a basis of hatred and polarization and dissension. That is a big nisayon, and that is a test that we sometimes don't pass very well, which is why we still have a Chorban, because of the hatred that exists among Jews. But in theory, there can actually be a celebration. There's actually a medrash that says that a garden is much more beautiful if there are many different types of flowers in the garden than if it's all one type of flower. Hashem wants these different derachim. So that's kind of where it is. Yeah.
Going on that, how much should Jews today, maybe it's different for Baal Shuvah, I don't know, kind of explore these different like hashkafas within Judaism, like talk to different rabbis or learn different ideas from these different groups to really explore and see what's right for them, or kind of just go with whatever.
It is a good question. I think in theory, one should explore. Certainly, one should learn about Ashkenazim, Sfardim, Hasidus, and of course, in the course of your aliyah, of your growth as a Jew, you need to find the derech that is right for you. And that's a certain amount of experimentation within, again, I hasten to add, within the framework of halacha. The only problem is, of course, that life is short. Life is not unlimited. And if you do a little here, 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 you know, you never really have a solid foundation or base. So I think you need to establish a base. But then when you're anchored down, you can then go out and learn about other things as well. Hasidus is a very good example. I mean, in the Litvashe yeshivas, the non-Hasidic yeshivas, they're non-Hasidic. So historically, Sifrei Hasidus were not studied at all. And not only were they not studied, but if you learned them, you could get in trouble, so to speak. But if you walk today, into, whether it's Panovich or Chevron or Mir or Or Sameach, etc., you will see that even in the strong Litvashe yeshivas, many, many Talmidim, not everybody, very, very far from everybody, but there's a sizable number of people that draw on Sifrei Hasidus because they see, they get inspiration, they get chizuk, they get growth in their Avodas Hashem. And it was understood that that's a good thing to kind of introduce. I mean, Sefer HaTanya is... Chabad is a complicated case because it's interwoven with other issues like Mashiach and the like. But the Sefer HaTanya as a Sefer was in fact a Sefer of Limut in non-Hasidish Litvashe yeshivas. Rav Dessler learned Tanya and the like. And I see some people here learn Tanya. I see a Tanya on the shelf there, and you referred to it earlier. So it's understood that we need to draw from many Makairis, and that makes us richer and deeper. But when you draw from many, you still have to have a yesod, you have to have a foundation. You can't just take a little here, a little here, a little here, a little here. By the way, there are actually two people that we can credit, or blame, for the introduction of Hasidus into the Litvashe Beis HaMedrash. In the United States, it was Rav Huttner, who brought Rav Tzadok into the Yeshiva Shul, the Sfasemes Rav Tzadok, and in Eretz Yisrael it was Rav Dessler. And it was very, very interesting, because when Rav Dessler became Mashgiach in Panovich and he began to mention Tanya and Sfasemes and Rav Tzadok, you know, Rav Dessler mentions these, so some of his old Chaverim from Kelum, which was the bastion of traditional Musar, they were very upset. They were very, very upset. And they say, why are you bringing in new things that we never discussed? But Rav Dessler said, the door is a different door, and different things inspire them that perhaps we didn't need. And so Hasidus has that admission. So it's true for a lot of things like that. Yeah?
Two quick questions. One is, if you have no option but to daven, and there's only a Reform minion around, can you daven in that minion?
Generally not. Now, let me just explain why that's so, because it really depends on what you're describing. If it's a minyan, well, first of all, a reform minyan could actually be 10 women. That's one thing. But if they are counting women in a minyan,
yeah,
for sure, you know, it's not a minyan. So
no, my question, but it's like specifically if it's like 10 men.
Okay, if it's 10 men, so then it depends. If there's also women there, you have a problem of no mechitza. Now, let's take a best case scenario where it's 10 men, no women are there. So first of all, the Reform Siddur, the Reform Prayer Book itself, you really have to look. Maybe conservative might be different, but if you look, they take out things like resurrection of the dead. They take out major things from the Siddur because they don't believe in physical resurrection. They don't believe in Mashiach.
Huh? If you're praying from your own Siddur, but you're just standing in the minyan.
Well, the question becomes, though, are you? In other words, I'll just ask you what possible purpose. In other words, like this: if you're asking me, am I yotzei davening with the minyan? The answer is no, because they're not saying the davening that is halachically proper. Now, if you're asking me, am I allowed to daven simply because I happen to be? In other words, two different issues. If you're asking me, am I yotzei davening with the minyan? The answer is no. If you're asking me, am I allowed to daven? So here, mi'ikara din, yes, but Rav Moshe says no, and the reason he says no is maris ayin. If you're davening while they're praying, then it looks like you're doing it with them. You're not allowed to do it with them. Now, people sometimes ask me this question. I've had this question. Let's say you have a cousin, and your cousin is having a bar mitzvah or a bas mitzvah in a Reform synagogue. And they want you to come in and listen to him or her, well, Kalisha, but putting that aside, listen to him read something from the Torah or give a speech. So clearly, Moshe said, you're not allowed to daven when they're saying their prayers. But am I allowed to simply go and sit and just look like a spectator? So there are different views. Some are machmer, some are mekel. If you sit like a rock and all you're doing is watching and you're not saying any davening, so some do permit that. So there you'd have a little bit of a hedger, because the marasayin would only be if you're actually davening from a sitter or something like that. Yeah.
Going off on that, is it true that praying at just having a religious minyan pray at a Reform building is it considered avodah zarah?
That's actually a different question, and that is, okay, let's say my whole minyan is Orthodox, my whole minyan is from, but the only room we have, we're renting a room in the Reform synagogue, is it forbidden to pray in the actual Reform sanctuary, even if your minyan is 100% kosher? That's another machlokas, but you are correct. Rav Moshe, not everybody, but Rav Moshe was very strict on that, because he said that since a Reform sanctuary is an area where they publicly deny the Torah comes from heaven, so you're not supposed to daven in a place of heresy and kefira, even if you're davening in a kosher way. However, as I say, some people are lenient, and even Rav Moshe, that would be machmir, would permit you to daven in a classroom, in other words, a room in the Reform building that is not the room of the services itself. So that would be permitted. In fact,
Your opinion is most of the Yidden, if it was 10 Reform men.
That's a very good point as well. There's no reason to assume today that they're even Jewish, because number one, the Reform movement follows patrilineal descent. In other words, if the father is Jewish, the kid is Jewish. And number two, the Reform movement has all sorts of standards for conversion that are not halachically valid. So that would be an issue as well. But again, as I say, anyway, you can't be part of them. And even the room itself, Rav Moshe says, you cannot pray in the sanctuary. But still, I would still tell you, if all you're going to do is enter the sanctuary and not do any praying, they want you to ask a shaila, but there would be a grounds to be lenient for that, for shalom bayis or for some very, very important reason. Yeah.
From what I understand, it's permissible to pray in a mosque.
Yes, well, that's right. First of all, if actually this Shabbos is the big Shabbos to be in Hebron. I don't know if anyone, maybe that's why they made a Beis Medrash Shabbaton. This, I don't know, but this is Parshas Shabbos Chayisara, in which thousands and thousands of people come to Hebron. And the, unfortunately, Bavnesenu HaRabim, the kvarim of our avos are in a mosque. A mosque is built over Maras HaMachpelah. So whenever you go to Hebron and you have the great privilege of davening in next to the kvarim of the avos and the imais, you're praying in a mosque. But again, the difference is pashut, that as despicable as the Arabs are, and they certainly do many, many evil things, Islam is an absolutely monotheistic religion. Islam is not idolatry, and therefore it is not a place in which God is denied. A mosque is better than a group of Jews who are denying the Torah. You know, that would be the difference. You couldn't daven in a church. If, God forbid, there would be a church built over Maris HaMachpelah, you could not daven in the church. Yep, sorry. Did you want to say?
I said they also have a starke machitza.
Yes, well. Right. Okay, you all be well, and we'll see you next week. Yeah.